Hello and welcome to the Sonic Cinema Podcast. My name is Brian Scuttle. Thank you for joining me at www.sonic-cinema.com, as well as the Sonic Cinema Podcast YouTube channel. You can click subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether it's the YouTube channel, Spotify, Good Pods, Apple Podcasts, basically wherever you listen to podcasts, you can find us. The YouTube channel, we also get quick take reviews from me. As well as if you are a Patreon subscriber, you also get access to excerpts from Q&As at film festivals and all sorts of other stuff. Speaking of Patreon, you can check us out at patreon.com/SonicCinema. There you will get older new watch reviews, short film block reviews, such as I have been doing over the Renegade Film Festival and coming up in the Atlanta Film Festival. That is at patreon.com/SonicCinema. So it's interesting the timing of this particular episode. This is actually an episode that I've had on the mind for a few months, and I was originally thinking about for this time of year just because of the fact that based on the way the episodes were lining up, this one made the most sense in this particular case. But we actually had the passing of one of the great actors from this movie, happen this past week. And that just made the relevance of this discussion much more impactful. And that is the, passing of Val Kilmer. And so, but there's also another reason the timing of this episode is interesting. If you listen to the previous episode, which is discussing police films and basically propaganda, authoritarian states, and the idea of law and order in fascist cinema, I actually opened that episode with a story from my college years, and it was on the way, and you can go back and listen to that episode to hear this story. My guest today was the one who was I was actually going to see when that story happened. She's been a friend for well over 25 years now. We met at Georgia State University. We were both in the music industry track. We did recording collaborations in studio. She's also played piano on several pieces of mine, and I'm very pleased to welcome to the first for the first time on the podcast Dawn Echols. Thank you very much for joining me, Dawn.
Oh, I'm so excited. This is going to be so much fun. I've had such a great number of intellectual conversations over the years about starting with film, but our topics end up ranging to great literature from even ancient times. I'm thinking we've probably even touched on things like The Scarlet Letter or War and Peace and, you know, things that you wouldn't normally, sometimes people who think about great ancient literature that has stood the test of time, you would not think about that being relevant to film, but film is another form of art that expresses life just like literature.
And one of the things that I think there have certainly been times where we've had discussions about film over the years, but it really, one of the things that's really striking about our friendship is that it's less about discussing film than a lot of my other friendships are. I mean, certainly other podcasters that I have gotten to know over the years, we all have a shared love of film. You and I, we've certainly talked about film over the years, but it's not really been a huge part of our friendship dynamic. I mean, music was obviously a big part of it, but as the years have gone on, it's been as much about life and what's going on in our lives. And as we've gotten away from Georgia State and as our lives have kind of taken shape from Georgia State in very differing ways, I think, needless to say, both of us had when we were at Georgia State.
Right. Yes. Yeah. It's that's so true because, as you say that, I'm like, yeah, we've had conversations about art and film, and it always they spring from less about film and more about what's happening in our lives and how if we've discussed film literature or any other form of art, it's been its impact on us relevant to those life topic discussions. And that's probably why our shared interest and even necessity, in terms of being partners in the music lab stuff, when we would collaborate on recordings. And I think even though this is a podcast about filming, you talked about me being featured, which I loved doing. Still want you to do me an anxiety track at project so that I can make that available in the psychology world. But the fact that you were a key player and a critical impact on me being able to do my own recordings of projects that were important to me that I could make available to friends and family, if nothing else. When I was teaching piano and how each of my students, I had, we did those projects together. So those things are, you've played an important role in projects in my life. But yes, our friendship sort of grew from there. We had this shared interest and then, of just trying to survive school. and projects at school where we were literally out of practical need helping each other. And then from there, just those shared topics about life as life threw challenges to us and how we evolved from that. And I was thinking about when you were talking about how we've talked less about film, I thought, yes, because our interests are pretty divergent. Yours go really deep and wide. True film critic, thinking about it in all levels and appreciation for all the aspects of it. And I'm a typical consumer. I sit and watch it for pure entertainment value, usually, without really giving a lot of deep thought until you and I have a conversation, or I read one of your blogs, or I look at your reviews. And then I kind of go, oh. And typically something I would not consider if I read your reviews, I will then go back and go, oh, I might give that a run. I might give that a try because I'm a classic lightweight consumer, and you and I've joked about that over the years. I tend to go for the really almost fluff stuff in a sense, either action or because of my marriage and my husband's great sense of humor and optimism, I've learned to truly appreciate the romantic comedy. He's also a hopeless romantic, as you well know. But it's, those tend to be what I go for. And certainly because of my job, I don't watch a lot of heavy stuff. It's a form of self-care for me where I truly do look at film as more entertainment value for me. But then that's what makes this conversation about Tombstone so cool because one of the reasons this is one of my all-time favorite, I think I have watched Tombstone more than maybe any other film in my life. I can recite a lot of the dialogue. I'm like a kid with their favorite movie. And it's because it means so much more to me than why I originally watched it, which was for its action and entertainment fluff. So yeah, it's got so much more to it. And of course, Val Kilmer, in my opinion, and not taking away, it's an excellent cast, and we'll talk about that, I know. But Val Kilmer's role might be my favorite in that movie of all the roles. So in this sense, Val Kilmer stands out in this movie as my favorite role of my favorite movie of all time in many ways. And I, as I'm doing this interview with you, I'm thinking, is there anything else I like better that I've watched over and over? And while I do watch some movies more than once, and I've watched them three or four times for their comedy or whatever, every time this movie's on, and my husband and I joke, even with my mother-in-law, my niece has sat through it. My mother-in-law, who's 90, like, you got to watch Tombstone if you haven't seen it. So we'll watch it again, and I can say the lines, it's the depth of it and what he brings to it, and what he brought. And of course, my husband says his attention. It's too bad he's not part of this. I didn't even think about it. He talks about Val Kilmer's breadth as an actor. And he can appreciate other roles. One of his favorite role Val Kilmer was in was The Saint. And he says, Don, it's not just how great he is in this movie, it's how great he's been in every movie with the impact he's made.
And I mean that's actually just a great transition to go ahead and get into Tombstone, which is the subject of this discussion. I'll be honest, and maybe you told me this at some point over the years. I didn't even think about this as being your favorite movie when you brought up as a possibility for joining me on the podcast. But I'm sure that we'll get into a little bit more of why that's the case, because it's funny because this is the most recent time I watched it, which was this past week in prepping for this episode, was probably my fourth time watching it over the years. I know I watched it theatrically with my mother. I feel like I had to have watched it at least one time before, as I was getting into DVDs in the early 2000s and stuff like that. I know when I reviewed it for Sonic Cinema back in 2019, and then this most recent time. So that was the four times. So yeah, I enjoyed it. I look at it mainly from the perspective of entertainment. It's something that I enjoy watching. It's but also is not necessarily something that has had, I mean, other than Kilmer's performance as Doc Holliday, which we'll get to, there's not a whole lot of me thinking about it much afterwards. I mean, part of that is because of the fact that I've watched thousands of movies since then. But it's also the fact that his performance just stands out so much over everything else in this movie, which, don't get me wrong, is very, very good. It just galvanizes our entire thinking about the movie. And so you basically, I it's funny, my first question as we got into the movie was going to be, what made you bring up this episode? We can this movie for this discussion, and we can still get into it because even though you've already mentioned a big part of it, you haven't also, as far as it being one of your favorites, I'm sure there's also more to get into that. For a little bit of context, Tombstone's directed by George P. Cosmatos, came into the film late, after the original director was fired. Cosmatos also directed First Blood Part Two, which actually, oddly enough, may or may not be on the podcast later this year, as well as the Sylvester Stallone film Cobra. So you kind of get an idea of where his sensibilities as a filmmaker are because of that. Kurt Russell is the main actor here. He plays Wyatt Earp, and it's essentially Wyatt Earp going to Tombstone with his brothers Virgil and Morgan, played respectively by Sam Elliott and Bill Paxton.
Amazing job there too.
Oh yeah, just this cast is amazing.
It's
Like
Dana Delaney.
that's Dana Delaney, Michael Biehn, Michael Rooker, Thomas Hayden Church, Charlton Heston, Billy Bob Thornton is in here, Jason Priestley, Robert Mitchum on the voiceover. I mean, my God, like that is one of the things I love about movies from this era that sadly we don't really get a whole lot of outside of big franchises that are adding characters constantly. And this is individual movies with just massive casts. And I mean, this is such an example of that. But so you've already talked a little bit about what it is that made you bring up Tombstone as a possibility for this discussion. When did you first see it, and what was it about the film that latched on to you that way? Because I mean, especially when we're talking about favorite movie, it feels like it's always going to be something different, regardless, depending on what the movie is going to be. And I think that is, I know for me, my favorite movies have a very specific reason for being that way. So what is it about Tombstone that has really set itself apart from you in that respect?
Honestly, I think the first time I saw it, I consumed it as an action film, and I love the comedy, the comic moments in the film that you don't the subtle comic moments in the film, particularly contributed by Val Kilmer more than maybe any other role for the comic moments. Just the subtle sarcasm of them, and the delivery of those. And like you said, these epic or sort of massive casts, they're actually very difficult to pull off and gel together the way this cast did too. Like you think of other ma like some a lot of times when I see movies advertised and they are billing it on all these names that are supposed to draw you in, I tend to actually be skeptical going, oh, this is going to be a flop, because it gets over heavy at the top almost in a sense, and you lose something. So this cast gelling together with all the names you mentioned is a real tribute to the entire team that made this film. I was thinking about the opening lines with just the music. So to answer your question, I tend to like when I think about films and so forth, like what does draw me back to them. So two others that might be future topics that we could talk about as you were is another film I loved that did strike me a lot quicker than Tombstone, to go back as I'm circling around to answer your question, was Skyfall. I'm a big Bond fan, and it is my absolute all-time favorite Bond movie because of where it stands out in the franchise. And another one that you and I could really dig deep and totally enjoy talking about, or at least I do, is Dallas Buyers Club. I'm a Matthew McConaughey fan because my husband and I love romantic comedy, and nobody delivers romantic comedy, and at least in my adulthood, maybe better than Matthew McConaughey. I may not be being fair to some others. As you know, before we even I realized that Tombstone was my favorite film, when being asked, I would often respond they would be Stallone films, all of them almost. Certainly his franchise films. I love Rocky. I love Rambo. I have all of those. I am and still am a big Die Hard franchise fan. Like you hear the action movie buff in me when you hear those names, and so. Prior to me realizing how drawn I was to Tombstone, you and I had these discussions, and you knew those were my favorite franchises, just in passing. And we would laugh about that because they were fluff films you couldn't necessarily dig deep about. However, I think I could dig deep with the Rocky stuff. And one of my favorite quotes right now is, "It's not about how many times you've been hit; it's how many times you've been hit and still get up." And I'm not saying that correctly, but it's just such an incredible line that is. That idea of overcoming adversity that speaks to me as a therapist for people. But with Tombstone, when you asked me that question, and it wasn't until maybe the fourth time I saw it or later, and I was trying to come up with, and I won't get into that for this podcast, but I've been asking these icebreakers at work events, like, what's your favorite film? And when I would answer with these action movies, my answer would sort of fall flat. And so I said, well, Tombstone's one of my favorite movies. And then as I answered the question in these icebreaker events, I realized it actually was more favorite and I had watched it more often. And as people would not understand that, I kind of found myself, and you and I've had a passing conversation that gave you the spark for this podcast episode. And I said to you, Brian, I don't get it. Don't they know this movie's about friendship? And then it hit me as I said it to you out loud. It's like, oh my gosh, that is the draw for me. These are imperfect, real people that existed. The great delivery of this movie is it doesn't try to be true to the actual story. But I was so drawn to the movie, probably even after you and I talked about it, I went and checked out books at the library to read about the real Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday and the female characters. I wanted to understand Josephine. I wanted to understand the real relationship between Wyatt Earp and Josephine. I wanted to understand Big Nose Kate, and that's the psychologist in me in a sense that says, what is it about that that is drawing me? And these are imperfect people who were living, I love how when they write about Val Kilmer, when they write about Doc Holliday, And they write about Wyatt Earp in the actual books on them, biographies or studies of them. They talk about their walking both sides of the law and the shady, switching sides when necessary and the loosey-goosey kind of thing. And it's, obviously biographers are not there to romanticize this the way the movie does. But what draws me in, without it having to be true or not, is the friendship that is displayed between Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday, the loyalty, the having your back, the acceptance of each other's flaws. That's what brings me back to it over and over.
I think, and I definitely, when I wrote about it in 2019, I definitely point to the friendship. And I think I had you. I think I had your thoughts in my head when I was writing that review because of the fact, I mean, obviously it is a big part of the film, but I didn't necessarily, but it was interesting when I rewatched it this time, I think is the first time I really started to think about in those contexts. And one of the things that is really interesting in this film. So one of the things that was most fascinating for me watching it this time around was the fact that the film, we start with Wyatt going to Tombstone to be with his brothers. They are going to make money, go on their way, and Doc just happens to be there. And one of the things that is so fascinating about this film is the way that there's a tension between Virgil and Morgan and Doc because they feel like Doc is not necessarily a good influence for Wyatt. And I think that's really fascinating. They're obviously looking out for him, and there's just this tension in general because of the fact that, Wyatt Earp, by this point, he'd been a U.S. Marshal. He'd been in law enforcement, and they were trying to get away from that. And the events that take place with Curly Bill and Johnny Ringo in Tombstone basically force their hands to get back into law enforcement. I think that's that tension between the brothers and Doc Holliday for Wyatt's attention and really the connection between the brothers and then this friendship is really fascinating to watch.
Yes, it's so good that you brought that up because, there they are. Yes, they're trying to make their fortune, but there is this foundation they're starting to introduce about family and sibling relationships, in this case, in the context of this film, brotherhood. And then the backstory in the relationship with the brothers is their relationship with their wives and how those women came into their lives. And that what the each brother's history brings to that marital relationship each of them have, or they're trying to have, and how Morgan, you don't see as much of that marriage, because obviously Virgil with Sam Elliott becomes wounded, so you see his wife a little more. But of course, the main focus is on Wyatt Earp and his compromised marriage. It even brings in the opiates and heroin type stuff, and the problems that really probably happened that we don't read about very much in history, except for a passing thing where a biographer will note that, when what we know about addiction is that it impacts lives in a ripple effect. And I've said a lot of times to clients as a therapist, addiction is a vortex that sucks everyone into it if you don't get help for it. And even family members sometimes have to get help when their loved one isn't going to. And so it sort of frames this context. It doesn't excuse Wyatt Earp having an affair. It dances around it so that you're left in the context of great art, you're left to not be entirely sure the first time you watch the movie exactly what they're doing and if they're really having an affair. You don't know it, but you have to figure it out. So you see this, and that's great film in my opinion. Where you're not told everything, you have to use your brain in the context of great literature, great art. Like, what is it you get from it when you watch it? And what does it teach us about ourselves and our relationships? So we've got this brother relationship that they're starting fresh. And then interestingly enough, it flips later in the later when Virgil is the one that says, you can't stand by and let wrongdoing happen. And Wyatt's going, I just want to make,
Yeah.
and so it's, and but yet Wyatt becomes the person who fights the hardest, and then they're angry at Wyatt. And it's such a push-pull that is so relevant to real relationships, how we sometimes switch positions in our important relationships, and we're not always a straight line. In fact, we all probably never are, we think we are. And these brothers certainly don't have a straight line relationship with each other, with their spouses, and with their friends. So yeah,
Yeah.
it's fascinating.
No, and to your point, the fact that it's Virgil and Morgan that get back into law enforcement, that realize that they need to be involved in law enforcement again before Wyatt, really does say a lot about them as characters and how for them this is. Yes, ultimately, they would like to have this bond together where they're able to just live lives and let things, and do what they want to do. But at the same time, you get to the point where you realize it's just not that simple. And it's something that all of the actors, Kurt Russell, Sam Elliott, and Bill Paxton, they all play this dynamic between the brothers so great. And I mean, they're all three of them are, or in the case of Paxton, were fantastic actors. Sadly, we've lost Paxton as well as Kilmer now.
I know.
But, it is interesting. You brought up the wives, and you definitely see the wives are as part of a as big an important part of the trio of them as anybody. And, the as well as oh, is it Kate, the woman that Doc Holliday is with.
Doc Holliday's paramour, maybe we would call it.
Yeah. And the thing that I love about that is that of her character is that she's very much in the same vein as these wives. Well, with the exception of Wyatt's wife, which is more you see the tension because of the addiction to opiates. And so
And
that
possibly
is,
Wyatt's former indiscretions.
yeah.
It's highly likely there may have been others,
Oh, yeah. And then with the introduction of Josephine in the story, she comes into Tombstone with the actor played by Billy Zane, another
Amazing.
big part in
Yes.
this movie. You know, even if you are only somewhat familiar with the story of Wyatt Earp, you kind of get an impression of where that arc is going with Josephine. And you understand it because of the fact that it's just further distance. It's weird because it's something that not only further distances him from his wife, but also the bond with the brothers.
Yes, it does. Which relationships do that sometimes? I mean, we want them not to be that way. We want to, if we have good relationships with our siblings in real life, we want our partners that come into our lives to gel with not just our family, like our siblings or our everybody focuses kind of when when a person gets married, the focus often is on parents, but the siblings play from a therapist standpoint, siblings can play as important, if not a more important role, in the gelling of how a person's relationship develops and where their support system comes from. And you want your friends to like
Yeah.
your partners, whether it's girlfriend, boyfriend, spouse, whatever. And so it, but this is, but this film reflects what can happen with an impactful relationship. And you know, of course, the film presents it, and then that was the one of the other things is Charles Mitchum with his great narration of this and how he closes the film and the narrative is what prompted me to kind of go, I want to read like what really happened. It's narrated for this movie, but did this really happen for these guys? Those are the facts. Let me go. Are those all the facts? Are those accurate? You know, they're presented as facts in the narrative. So I went, that's one other reason I hit my library and said, I want to read about Big Nose Kate and I want to read about Josephine and like, who were they and what were they about? And of course, you know, as often happens, and it's not a, I'm not saying this as a damnation of what happens because we're looking at the characters, but you know, there's less about them as women. We, you know, women sometimes have this, you know, they have this important role, but they are, as a backdrop, when really, in some ways, with these brothers, they weren't just the backdrop in their lives. They were the maybe reason. These guys were trying to have it, you know. And then Wyatt famously says to Josephine, I want a family and kids, and I'm, you know, want to write down to the ground. And she said, really? And I just love how Dana Delany plays this character without the darkness that might have been viewed this way in that culture. Of where she challenges norms and she's okay with making decisions. She's okay with owning her place. Now, granted, her parents, as presented in the film, are the reason she has the freedom because she has a source of income. You know, Big Nose Kate, on the other hand, is having to do cards too, and may have been, you know, very likely was a prostitute, just like Wyatt Earp's wife was a prostitute. And that's what's so cool about Wyatt Earp's character played by Kurt Russell is this love that he, you know, does have, this bond he has, in spite of the fact that he, you know, commits adultery by standards of morality, and he has an affair, and he hurts her for that. You know, she's hurt by that. She knows he prefers her at some level, maybe quicker than everybody else does. And as a result, she is also blind to seeing the dilemma he faces in some ways. Because she's hurt by this affair and she's and her mind is altered by drugs, right? And but yet there is an acceptance of each other as flawed human beings who've come together to attempt at a partnership that ultimately fails. And so I looked her up and she did die of an opium overdose, which was really sad, you know. As he's struggling with his, you know, what you'd call, you know, morality, you know, she leaves Tombstone. In the wake of Morgan's death with the brothers because he's attempting to do right by his wife. At that point, he thinks he's completely abandoned this tryst and thing he's had with Josephine, you know. And so, and it's interesting too when you were talking about this, we were talking about this back and forth switch and tension in the brothers' relationship. He joins law enforcement again, Wyatt Earp, and Kurt Russell does such a great job with this. He joins his brothers out of loyalty for his brothers, just like he and Doc Holliday ultimately have this loyalty. But it's loyalty to his brothers that makes him put the badge back on. But then it's the death of Morgan that changes his trajectory. That the brothers then completely are removed from the film for good reason, right? I mean, Morgan is killed and Virgil is injured. So I looked up, you know, what really happened to Virgil. He became an actual law enforcement officer, I believe, if I remember correctly. I have to go back sometimes because this movie is so powerful in the way it presents it that I'm like, wait a minute, did I hear that in the movie and did I verify it in the document? Like, did I verify it in the biography? You know, did I really read that Virgil did become and live in California? So we don't know. They don't really say, but some part of me that looks at the sibling relationship says, were Wyatt and Virgil, did they stay in touch? Yes, time was different. We didn't have technology. You didn't travel as easily. You know, where in California did they each live? You know, how did I think Virgil, if I remember correctly, did stay with his, you know, with his wife, and they lived, and he became a sheriff, a one-armed sheriff. But like then you're like, well, the books don't tell you what happened with Virgil and Wyatt after the death of Morgan. You know, did Virgil and Josephine? It was, and it is a great love story that I think this movie hints at and doesn't, it does what great movies do, and that it delivers it in this great love story theme that makes for good cinema. But it's not a, you know, it has it that relationship has its own history. You know, it doesn't have some, you know, lovely whitewashed beginning.
Right. Well, I mean, to quote a to quote the great director John Ford, who made dozens upon dozens of great classic westerns in his time, including one about Wyatt Earp, My Darling Clementine. When I think it's John Ford who said, when choosing between when deciding between the truth or the legend, you print the legend. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but it's the same basic idea. And I mean, no, it's one of those things where, look, obviously there's something to be said about film that plays very true to the facts of the reality of a true story, but ultimately you're going for. But ultimately is about the emotional connection we make with these characters, the emotional connection we make with the story. And so, I mean, look, we're at a time when we're talking about 1993, we're talking about the 90s, we're talking about a time where there were a lot of movies inspired by true stories that didn't necessarily play genuine with the facts, but get the emotions behind the idea, the stories right. And
And
that
I think,
is that that's where film is most impactful.
and really, if you look at it throughout time, our heroes that inspire us are, we are given their bigger than life story. And that's important because of the inspiration it provides. You know, some of our most beloved modern day heroes were flawed human beings that at times history, the press, whatever, kind of tried to protect us from those foibles because either out of a sense of propriety, I'm thinking of the 1950s, you know, where those things were not printed in the press at time, you know, rarely. And I'm not presenting myself as a press expert or anything, but you know, some of our greatest heroes had some deep flaws in some ways. And but yet, you know, I think that's been true throughout time. There is no perfect hero in that sense. The only person that is, I love what my dad said to me years ago, and I think of that when we talk about these characters, even. I said to Dad in a moment when he, you know, rides in an old 1970 something used Ford we were all driving, and this was like the night, it was probably around the time of the Tombstone movie. And I said, "Daddy, I'm sorry that you had to come help me with this. You know, this was a poor decision on my part or whatever." And of course, I was a little emotional at that moment. It was a breakup and situation. And Dad looks at me in this the driest of terms. I mean, true like a Val Kilmer delivery in some ways in this movie. And Dad says to me, "You know, Dawn, there's only one perfect person, and they crucified him." And he just, you know, my father is a person I realized in a speech several years ago. I was at a women's colloquium at Brunel College where I got my master's, and the young woman, I say young, you know, she was under 30, that was doing the speaking, was talking about authenticity. And as I left the auditorium that day, reflecting on what this gathering had presented that was, you know, is designed to inspire and empower. Mostly in power, really, even. I thought, you know, I have an example in my life of authenticity right under my own nose, and that is my father, who has never hidden his flaws. My father, I knew my father was flawed by the time I was 14, if not sooner. And, you know, for better or worse in that situation, it prepared, I knew, I fast forward to the moment he was tied to the bed as they were trying to pull the ventilator out of him with a quadruple bypass, and I was, you know, over 40 years old at that point, and he was over 65. And I remember standing there thinking, because I knew he was flawed, and I've been able to grow up and have an adult relationship with him, I'm able to be here for him and handle this on reality's terms today. I'm not falling apart as a child. I can do what I need to do for my dad right now in this moment. It was very hard to see him weak. My father is an, as you know, is an incredibly big presence and personality. Totally intense. I get it coming and going from both of my parents to have an intense personality. And my dad is can be the classic, what we think of as with our fathers as bigger than life. These characters in Tombstone are bigger than life, you know, and these characters in real life were big characters. That, I mean, they were big characters, big personalities in real life. And I love what John Ford says, you know, when you choose, you print the legend, because we need, I think we need the legends. I really do.
The legend is important. I mean, and by doing that, I'd like to think we're not necessarily denying the truth of these individuals'
Yes.
fragility and their flaws as human beings,
Yeah.
but we're giving them the grace to look at the positive aspects of who they are as individuals. And I think that's important. I mean, it's like it's funny you're talking about that with your father. As you know, and this will be the first episode that this is presented on. I recently lost my mother, and you know as well as I do, my mother, like your father, had a
Big
huge
personality.
personality and is somebody who I have had very complicated feelings I've had to go through over the years.
Yeah.
And to your point, the ability to see her as a human being in her entirety as a human being
Yeah.
is a big part of the reason why the past few years, when she's needed me to take care of her, I've been more willing to do it because.
Yep.
Yes, I still think about a lot of the negative times in my life with her, but I also know that who she was at the at as a whole is not that person.
Yes.
And she deserved and she more than earned my ability to take care of her over the
Yes.
years.
And I think that's the growth of human beings in their relationships, is that ability for you know, to earn something, have reciprocity in our relationships, where a parent meets us where we are. You know, I have often said that one of the things that I great one of the greatest among many, you know, there's top five type greatest things my parents did, I feel like, that is truly amazing, for which I'm very grateful for. But you know, it's funny, you know, as I with each decade that I got older, the focus was more on what they did right rather than what they did wrong. And it doesn't mean that I should not have focused on what I was also had to be the lightest about, complicated feelings about. And of course, you met me in the wake of one of those decades as I had worked through some of that and was still very much you know, could say it really out loud, no problem. But the greatest gift that my parents, I think, did give me, and I do believe it's contributed to my ability as a therapist to be there for clients in a way that they need, is my parents were honest. And especially my mom. My mom would tell the stories of our family. And that's what film does, is it tells the stories of things. And you know, but mother would do it without whitewashing the truth. My mother would say things that were non-blaming, but would not deny the reality of what might have really happened, where she had her own complicated relationship with her parents. And I wouldn't have known to call it complicated when I was 10, but I absolutely knew it was there, because she, in a non-blaming way, was very open about that in an appropriate, like at 10 years old, I didn't know what I knew at 20, right? Because my mother delivered that information in this intuitively wise way, She became a parent the first time at age 20, and but she would deliver age-appropriate knowledge without ever lying. And I look at that and I'm really amazed by that now, and so I think film can sometimes do that for us as well, as it's delivering the legend so that we can draw from it. And I think too, kind of going back to our topic there, is it's not just the relationship with the brothers, because we have a lot of focus. You can click on anything online, whatever you're watching and listening to, and it's going to be family. Family's important. Family's important. And you hear that, and yes, it is. But friendships are important too. And I think that's, if we, and I love what I heard years ago before I really, when I was kind of involved in my own personal growth. So I would be looking at self-help. I started off reading self-help books to help me perform better in sales. And then it became about personal growth as I was reading. Like, how can I grow? And sorry, my brain goes in 100 directions and it just darted 10 of them. But it's this, oh, then they said, we have our family. We don't choose our family. What we got, right? And that's the great thing about what you mentioned about your mom, with that being willing to earn through that complication. Like, the word that comes up for me when I was listening to you, and I didn't want to overstate it or make it, whatever, is redemption. That concept, we all want to feel that we have redemption in our mistakes. How can we, in 12-step stuff, when I've worked in substance abuse world, they talk about making amends. And you do that more by changing your behavior than you do by what you say. You say it, so you own it. But then the process of growth in that, for a person that's working one of those programs, they go from saying it. First, they have to admit it to themselves. It's one of the famous steps. And then they admit it to their higher power, and then they admit it to another human being that's safe. And then at that point, if you go 4 steps down the line on what they're working on, that's a big long journey type thing. It's not something you do right away. They then change that and own it through their actions, not just their words. And so, if we look at Wyatt Earp in this process, was he seeking redemption when, I don't think he was seeking redemption in the opening scene. But certainly somewhere along the way, and he wasn't thinking of it in terms of redemption. I think he would have, the character of Wyatt Earp, both real and in the movie, would have scoffed at that. Like, don't even talk to me about it. Like, he was too much of a gunslinger, for lack of a better word. And Val Kilmer's character of Doc Holliday would have just laughed.
Well, and so a couple of things before we start talking about Doc Holliday and
Okay.
Kilmer's performance,
Yes.
because I do want to make sure we get to that
Yes,
because
please.
there it's such an important part of this. So as you were talking about, I was also thinking, and when I say she kind of earned, my being there for her at the end, this isn't to say that she necessarily atoned for her mistakes when I was younger or anything
Right.
like that. It's that my thought process about her didn't put the negative ahead of what the positive she gave me over the years. And so when I say she earned it in my terms, in my thought process of not because of anything she did, but because my mind went to the point where she needs me, I need to be there regardless of whatever happened when we were young, when I was younger. This is what I need to do.
You're talking about the process of maturity that says, I see you go from,
And seeing our parents as human beings as opposed to just larger in life
characters.
beings that they are when we're younger. So that was the first thing. The second thing, and it's funny because of the fact that I wanted to make sure I got the quote right. So the original, so it's funny because of the fact that the original quote in the movie is from John Ford's film, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, is when the legend becomes fact, print the legend. But there's an interesting mis there's a misquoting of that line from the great Larry McMurtry, when he wrote the epigraph to his novel, The Last Kind Word Saloon, he said, "I had the great director John Ford in mind when I wrote this book. He famously said that when you had to choose between history and legend, print the legend, and so I've done." And it's funny because of the fact that that book is apparently about the legend of White Earp, not necessarily. So, again, tying back to Tombstone. But it's interesting because the way I quoted it is more along the lines of McMurtry's quote than the original quote itself. So
Yes, isn't that interesting?
I wanted to double check and make sure what the exact quote was before we moved on.
Yes,
But
give credit. Give the proper credit to John Ford on how
and so when legend becomes fact, print the legend. That, of course, brings us to Val Kilmer
yes.
and his performance of Doc Holliday. And, it's funny. I think when, it's weird because when this movie came out in 1993, it's kind of mind-blowing. You have to remind people that he didn't actually get an Academy Award nominated for this movie. He should have.
Yes, he
He
should
should
have.
have, especially rewatching it recently. I firmly believe he should have. But the thing is, when you consider two of the other performances that year were Ralph Fiennes in Schindler's List, whom I think everybody would agree is an absolutely monumental performance. And then the winner was Tommy Lee Jones for The Fugitive, which is a great performance in a popcorn movie in its own right. Kilmer's performance is very much right up there. And I think
Oh,
it's,
absolutely.
and I think one of the things, kind of going with this quote that we were talking about, I think one of the things about Doc in this movie is so fascinating is that he is a very flawed individual in terms of how he's lived. The way he's, it's very obvious in the way that they present the way he's lived that it's tuberculosis is a result of the individual that he is. And one of the things that I loved and respected about this film more this most recent time watching it than I think I recognize in any other time I've watched it is that the OK Corral happens 75 minutes into this movie, and it's very brief. Apparently, the actual fight lasts about 30 seconds. Chris Matos does not really stretch it out that much further. It's not this huge, elaborate set piece. It is what it is. The last 45, 50 minutes, especially when Virgil and Morgan are out of the picture, it really focuses more on Wyatt and Doc. And there's this idea in the last half of this movie about the idea of it's almost like Doc Holliday is wanting to make the end of his life mean something as he knows he's going to die. He knows he's near the end of his closer to the end of his life than he is to the beginning. And he wants to be there for Wyatt because Wyatt has been there for him, and he wants to make it count. And there's something really beautiful about the way Kilmer plays that. That is, and you see it the second when Wyatt's gone to go meet Johnny Ringo, and we think that he's coming up, and it's Doc first. And that's when we kind of realize, okay, this is how things are going. This is the type of person Doc is. And it's just such a rich performance, apart from being very funny, apart from getting the tension of that initial scene with Johnny Ringo and and Curly Bill played by
Yes.
Powers Booth together.
Yes.
But this character is many layers, and
Yes.
that is something that you don't necessarily anticipate when you first see him on screen, and it's not until later that we really start to realize it.
It's so funny that you say that because, I want to make sure we do talk about it because to me that's one of the reasons that's the reason I've come back to the film so much, I believe. But as an aside, just another aspect that makes this a great film is, with the roles we talked about with the other very what almost in some films would be bit parts, but they're playing something important. That moment of when, there Jason Priestley's character has been picked on, and I think it was Kurt who said, they made fun of him, and now he's going to ride with them. And then in that moment, which they kill, it's Powers Booth, right, that plays the actor. He plays such a wonderful character of truthfulness from the very first scene, the first moment he steps out of the carriage in his first appearance on screen, and he describes Wyatt Earp in this very dramatic, totally theatrical way, with a glint in his eye, literally as an actor. And then he dies, and Jason Priestley then has this moment in that character of instead of trading principles for friendship or belonging, I would call it belonging more so than friendship, because obviously the gang were not truly his friends, as Wyatt Earp says later in the movie. They weren't even really his friends. All they ever did was make fun of him. And they even made fun of him. There's a moment that the filmmakers give this nod to the idea of the fact that Jason Priestley is supposed to be playing an effeminate character who might possibly have been a homosexual. And, so as a gay man in the 1800s, oh my goodness, like what he would have dealt with and faced in real life. And there's a touch on that for a second, but I didn't see it so much as that being defining as it was that he wanted belonging like all of us, right? And he put up with things he should not have had to have put up with in order to belong. And that is true of many people. And then in that moment, Jason Priestley plays this character when they kill Powers Booth's character, and he says, "I'm done," because this man in his acting spoke to him and reached him in a place that this character had not been touched before with the Faust and everything he stood for as an actor in this film in the context of this period piece. So kind of just that's another thing this film does, but gets back to Val and his performance. This becomes a new, it's a nuanced performance from the beginning, right? I mean, like you said, he plays this character. I was so fascinated. I ended up reading on the real Doc Holliday. Doc Holliday was, I believe, a rather intelligent man. You have to wonder, how intelligent were these men, likely, right? And the women that were with them, obviously. And so, how intelligent was Big Nose Kate? I mean, come on. And so, but when he does this, when you talk about he wants his life to mean something, and then for me, what has spoken to me in the way Val Kilmer personifies Doc Holliday in the last, like you said, in this last third of the movie, he chooses friendship above all else because of what Wyatt has meant to him. And he and whether or not this and that was part of what prompted me to read about these real humans is like, were they these kind of friends, or is the film delivering this in a truly inspiring way? And does Val Kilmer deliver it even more? Like Kurt Russell delivers it about standing up for something once, like when his brother's killed, he's all in at this point. He has a turning point at which he will lay down his own life before he will ever give up on this battle of wrong, in a sense. And I love how Val Kilmer, when they're sitting by the river, and of course, he's out there walking on water. I mean, I just love, these lines that Val Kilmer delivers, literally from the very first moment, but certainly in the last third, you're just like, oh my gosh, the dialogue that was given and the way he delivers it, the writers of this dialogue, every one of these lines starts to become so impactful sometimes. And so he goes, you know, why are you here, doc? You're so sick. And I don't want to say that. I want to go back first. He understands Wyatt earlier, and I think I get those parts of the scene mixed up because they're all to me so significant at different times. But he says to him, he's out there trying to do justice or something. And Val Kilmer, of course, in the person of Doc Holliday, it's not that, it's the reckoning. He gets Wyatt. He gets Wyatt's character. They get each other in a way that maybe even Wyatt's brothers did not. And that's going back to what I started to say and may have interrupted myself. Friendship is what we choose. That's the family we choose. Friendship are that's the places we choose who we're connected to. And my mother used to say to me as a child, honey, who you choose is going to impact your life. She wouldn't say it that way. She would say things like, birds of a feather flock together. Things are going to be assumed about you based on who you choose as friends, honey. For girls and boys, that may mean something different in how it looks, but it ultimately means the same things. Like, we're judged by our group of friends at times, and my friendships have changed in my over the years. And my middle sister jokes about having so many friends across so many different spectrums because she's interested and she does not have to agree with her friend groups. And she has a group of, she even talked about at one point managing friends on social media in separate groups so they wouldn't fight with each other because they couldn't get along. But she likes it. She can appreciate it and she can kind of cut to, and of course, she's got a great sense of humor and a sense of mischievousness to her that makes her simply delightful. And she and the whether you talk about it as Doc Holliday or Val Kilmer, probably would have really enjoyed one another. And so Doc Holliday first gets Wyatt in this moment, and you get why they're friends then. Like, he understands him at a very deep level and accepts him, and they are knit together. And then when you talked about when he walks up and we think it's going to be Wyatt and it's Doc in his in the last in this last stand with Johnny Ringo, and what comes to mind for me in that moment are these epic kind of themes. And there's this like famous, I'd call it epic, sort of Bible verse from, I think it's Psalm, it might be somewhere else, but it talks about another heroic character of the Hebrew Bible, which is King David, and Jonathan, Saul's son, the prior king. And they have an epic friendship as well. And there is a passage there that says there's no greater love than this friendship between David and Jonathan. And I'm not going to quote it right, so I don't think I'm going to attempt to, but it's basically talking about and I might be even having the verses mixed up, there's no greater love than for a man to lay down his life for a friend. And Jonathan makes a choice in that story to give up everything for his love of David, who he considers like a brother. And they are not brothers. In fact, David is the contender for the throne that would take it away from Jonathan in that story, which is epic in itself in ancient times with the whole kings and sons and who's going to be, crown the next one and all that stuff. The whole deity type thing people tended to see with that kind of stuff, with, the king is supposed to be a deity. And so you think, and I'm mentioning that like it's nothing, but like that's a whole conversation in and of itself. Like, a person would give up their standing for the sake of a friend. And that's what you're talking about with Val Kilmer and how he delivers these layers with Doc Holliday, because he chooses in that moment. Yes, he's dying, right? But he chooses to risk dying in one layer for the sake of a friend because he wants his friend to live. And then on another hand, you could even say on the flip side, and I don't believe that it's a different layer to Val Kilmer's performance, and it's not as important, but it's still a layer. And that's what makes such a nuanced performance powerful, is there's also the confidence Doc Holliday had as being a gunslinger that he could get him, even sick as a dog. And he has those moments in this. That scene is more powerful than the OK Corral scene. Like you said, it's this, the OK Corral is what everybody talks about. And it's funny that what prompted us doing this podcast when I told you that, I would mention these movies in icebreakers and that they would fall flat. And when I mentioned Tombstone, people tend to only think OK Corral and Gunslingers. And which prompted my statement to you before we ever did this. Like, no, this movie's about friendship. This movie's about loyalty. This movie's about meaning. This movie is about change, about growth, about siblings, relationships, marriages, whatever, and belonging. All these different psychology themes to me emerge through it. And so Val Kilmer delivers all of those layers, in that he, this loyalty that he has, he will go, and then Wyatt Earp returns it in near the last scene when he keeps visiting him. And that, and I, you know me, I do not watch a lot of drama, partly because and people say, "Oh, Dawn, have you watched this?" No, I'm not going to cry. And it's not that I refuse to cry, it's that I don't. To me, that I've watched movies to be entertained. And I'm going to tell you, I can choke up just like what I'd said earlier about Dallas Buyers Club with Matthew McConaughey, which is an incredible movie, absolutely incredible. And it's about an unlikely friendship. So you and I could talk about that one in another podcast because of the friendships that evolve there. And in this moment at the end, when he says to him, and this will just render me to tears when I see it sometimes, and he says, "If you were ever my friend, leave Wyatt, leave now." And he wants this. And I think the reason it does that, it's not just if you ever loved me at all, please go. And it's the strength of these characters, the strength of these Westerners, the strength of these flawed heroes, these Western gunslinging men who had this questionable moral character. And in this moment, he says to him, "Leave me with my dignity if you love me. I do not want my friend who's seen me." And then, of course, classic Val Kilmer. And it took me forever to understand why this was funny, even though I knew it was funny. "Oh, isn't that funny?" As he delivers this classic Southern, because Doc Holliday was really a Southerner from, I think, Jonesboro, Georgia, right here in our own hometown, right? And he's wiggling his toes and he says, "Oh, isn't that funny?" I mean, it's just Val Kilmer just does such an inner. And of course, I was like way into it, seen it probably six times. And I'm like, "Oh, he's a gunslinger. He expected to die with his boots on." Like, it hit me. And I'm like, I always knew it was funny because Val could deliver it so well, but I didn't know why it was funny. And then I'm like, "Oh, this has just got a whole nother layer. There it is."
Yeah, Kilmer has some all-time line deliveries in this movie. I
Yes.
mean, everybody points to I'm your Huckleberry,
Yes.
but there's so much more to that. That last scene in the hospital where Wyatt goes to visit him,
Yes.
his plea, just go.
Yeah.
Do live your life.
If you're, yes.
You don't need to do this anymore. Just live.
And leaves him with a charge that's better for him as his friend. Go snatch her and live. Live, grab all the life you can while you can.
When Jack Johnson's talking to him at the end, "Doc, you ought to be in bed. What the hell are you doing this for anyway?" And he's like, "Wyatt Earp is my friend." It's like, hell, I got lots of friends. And Doc says, "I don't."
It's amazing. That's a very
That
powerful.
is, and that is just a moment where you get that sometimes friendships are more important to other people than not. And I
Yes.
mean, yes, if you have lots of friends, certainly it can be, oh, I've got lots of friends. Why are you doing this for him? And it's like in that line, Doc is, in those two words, Doc is basically saying, this is somebody who stood up for me when nobody else does.
Yep.
And he needs me right now.
Yep.
And then
Powerful life lesson.
I think the line reading that killed me the most in this most recent viewing was they're in the saloon and Doc is playing piano. And somebody says, oh, what is that song? And he goes, well, it happens to be Nocturne. And the guy goes, "A witch?" And he goes, "You know, Frederick fucking Chopin." As a pianist, I felt like I need to at least bring that one up because of the
It
fact that
yes.
the way he says Frederick fucking Chopin is
Like you
just
idiot.
old-timer,
Yeah,
just
I know.
absolute
I love that one.
amazing.
Yes. And of course, Dana Delaney's in that scene, you know, where she's been in there singing. I don't know if it's that one or another scene, but you know, it's where they live. These are the kind of characters they are. They live in the saloon. They don't live what was considered in the 1800s a righteous life at all. They live in saloons, they play cards, they have questionable moral character. They live outside the lines of proper society by far. But yet they become our heroes by standing up for something right. And I think that each of us have that call, and a performance like this can call us to that, is where in our lives do we stand for something that matters to us? And what is it that speaks to us? What is it that drives us? Is it because someone stood up for us when no one else would, because we were either an outsider, or we were the underdog, or we were judged, or we were flawed, or we made a mistake? Is it because someone helped us when we needed it the most, and our lives, the trajectory of our lives changed? People talk about that with a teacher. I have a good friend of mine who now it drives what she does with her job, because there was a teacher in elementary school that ran interference in a way they had the power to do so. Thankfully, they did have the freedom and power to do so without an over managed job, like I think teachers so often face now, when they're driven to want to help their students and love their students and guide their students, and then they're told they have to do, you know, 1400 pages and 1500 emails and go to these meetings and do all this stuff, and they really just want to help their kids and they teach them, and they don't want to spend writing 36 page reports on every single student. You know, when they want to focus on the student themselves. And it's so wonderful. You know, I had a conversation in the last 5 years with a fifth grade math teacher, and just in talking about something she wanted to do, she was trying. We did not know each other well. I had maybe only met her once. We crossed paths, and she was trying not to lose it in a sense. And when I say lose it, she didn't want to cry in front of someone she didn't know. But her eye, I'll never forget, her eyes filled with tears. She loved her 10-year-olds. She loved every student that walked through her classroom. And so teachers, foster parents, whatever, you know, someone comes across our lives, and the parent of a friend, we all have that chance to do something. And what is it we're going to do? Even if it's just a kind word and a smile in the course of our job in a given day, you know, when they talk about that, you don't know the power of what that might do to give someone hope. And I think a performance like Val's, and really Kurt Russell and every person in this film, it calls us to say, you know, like you said, Doc Holliday decides to, he changes, not, yes, it's for his life to have meaning, but his life is given meaning through what he chooses to do for a friend. Yeah. So it's an inspiring performance. It's absolutely inspiring to me.
No, it absolutely is. And it's funny. It's interesting because of the fact that I'm tearing up a little bit just now talking about it and hearing you talk, man. One of the things that I know I've said this to you before is that when we were in Georgia State, like I was very much, I was very much introverted. I was very much to myself. I didn't really have a whole lot of people I hung out with. And the fact that we, in a way, kind of found each other as friends in recording, in music industry, and the fact that it's just continued for decades
I
now
know.
is just remarkable. And I cannot thank you enough for being a friend at that moment. I know your friendship is a huge reason why I am the person I am today. And it's a big part of the reason why I'm comfortable enough doing this podcast in a weird way, because of the fact that, it allows me, I found my, in a weird way, I found my ability to open up to other people. is our friendship continued. And it really meant a lot to me. And so at the time, certainly I knew a lot of people that I would consider friends. I don't know that I knew a lot of people would consider close friends at the time. And I thank you for being one of those people at the time.
It's so funny that are powerful that you say that, because it's about what makes friendships work over time is when each person does invest in those, and the efforts, by you reciprocating in your own way as well, and putting value on the friendship to the point that you would invest the time to not let life, as we followed our paths, create that break that happens with people. And there's no blame that people let that happen, right? But you very persistently did not, you put value on that, and therefore you kept that conversation or that connection and that meaning going, to the point that at a certain place in our lives, I simply could respond in order to continue to enjoy the benefits of that friendship, And just to, we've had so many of our own almost movie moments. And as we approach wrapping up, I'm reminded of you saying, "Dawn, you went to get us coffee at Starbucks, right? And there we were paying all that money for Starbucks coffee because it was cheaper than buying food." And so, and you go to get us a coffee, and I was trying to survive on, so I would get my venti. I don't even remember the order now. It was so complicated. Like, I would get the venti latte with the breve latte with the power up shot, and it maybe had to have foam. I don't, it was this long, complicated order that literally, and you expressed it and had me, I still laugh when I think about you coming back with those cups of coffee. And you went to order them, and I was working on something in the lab, in the studio. And you said, "I'll go, Dawn." So you go down there and walk down the however many blocks and stairs we had to do. And you said, "Dawn," and you deliver me this venti coffee as you're drinking your small, simple black coffee. And you said, "This is our friendship, Dawn. The venti powered up froth cappuccino, breve, half calf. That's what it was. It had to be half calf." And you said, "And then I ordered my black coffee." And you're like, "I think this says what our friendship is," or something along those lines. And I'm like, "Oh my God, that's so true." You just wanted a simple black coffee. You didn't want to cause anybody any trouble. You're just like, "Can I please have a coffee? And I just need to pay." And then here I come, in and speaking to everybody in line and ordering a thing that only a very experienced barista could keep up with. So, unlikely friendships that make for legendary experiences.
And I can't think of a better way to wrap up this episode. Dawn, thank you very much for joining me. And I do hope it's the first of several times
Yeah.
when you're able to join me on the podcast.
You got it. I love that. Okay.
I'd like to thank Dawn for joining me on the podcast today. There's a lot to say about our friendship, and I'm sure if we get a chance to do this again, we'll talk more about it. That's going to be it for this episode of the Sonic Cinema Podcast. There's going to be a lot of different things coming up, whether it's the Atlanta Film Festival, whether it's talking about more favorites, as well as some complicated feelings about some of those favorites. Going to have more episodes about fascism and cinema. Looking forward to that. The wide variety of guests. And yeah. It's gonna be an interesting rest of the year. Thank you very much for joining me, whether it's wherever you listen to podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google, not Google, but Good Pods, or YouTube channel, patreon.com/sonic cinema, or at www.sonic-cinema.com. Thank you very much.